Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Neha Navarapu, and I am the host of this channel. Today, I am thrilled to be in conversation with Dr. Aniket Aga, author of the brand new book, Genetically Modified Democracy, which was published by Yale University Press in November 2021. Aniket Aga's research interests span science and technology studies, democratic politics, and agrarian studies. Genetically Modified Democracy is his first monograph. Hi, Aniket. It's so great to have you on the podcast and congratulations on your new book. It's so well written. It's so clearly argued and I really enjoyed reading it. And yeah, congratulations on the book and I hope you're celebrating.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Neha. Yes, I'm very, very happy that this book is finally out and very grateful to you for doing this podcast with me.
I mean, it's totally my pleasure. Let's start talking about the book soon, but I first wanted for us to get to know you a little better. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, perhaps your journey to graduate school and how you became an anthropologist in particular?
Sure. I've taken a circuitous path to anthropology, to be honest. My bachelor's is in electronics engineering from IIT Kharagpur, a sister institution of yours.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And my first job was with McKinsey in Mumbai. As a business analyst working with some of India's biggest firms, I learned many valuable skills. And one very valuable lesson that I learned was that the MBA corporate sector route was not for me. And so I decided that I had always been, since school, interested in social sciences, what I used to think is psychology and later turned out to be sociology, anthropology. Mm-hmm. So I ended up applying to a PhD in business management or PhD in business management programs in the US and got through to the University of Southern California. Mm-hmm. This is where I first studied sociology and history. And was really fascinated. It just opened my eyes to a whole new way of thinking. The trouble was that organization behavior, which was my doctoral program, so that the organization behavior in the US draws heavily on experimental social psychology, principally with American undergraduates as the subject population. And my interest lay in the kind of work happening in India by a range of people like Ashish Nandi, Nandini Sundar, Claude Alvarez, Kancha Ilaiya Shepherd, as also activists like Bela Bhatia, K. Balagopal, Father Tom Kocheri. I had very supportive faculty mentors in the business school and the sociology department, and they encouraged me to reapply to anthropology, as did my partner Chitrangada. And at that point, I don't know if that's changed now, but at least at that point, anthropology programs generally, but especially the one at Yale, was like a clearinghouse for people who didn't fit elsewhere. And I was both lucky and privileged to be admitted there.
that there is such an interesting route. And I think there have been many people on this podcast who've had a slightly offbeat track to anthropology, but I think yours is by far, I'm like, wow, you went to B school and then to anthropology. That's truly amazing. From electrical engineering to business school to anthro, then that's quite something. But we're like really glad that Yale Anthro was the place for you and gave birth to this beautiful book. So the book, as you put it in the introduction, frames genetically modified crops as a problem for both science and democracy. So could you tell us a little bit about what the stakes of the book are? Why are GM crops so controversial? And how did you start thinking about this book project?
So I got to Yale around, I got through to Yale around March 2010. Which is when the BT Brinjal or BT eggplant controversy in India was at the peak. Mm-hmm. The then Environment Minister Jairam Ramesh had imposed a nationwide moratorium on BT eggplant in Feb of 2010. So the topic immediately attracted me because it brought together three concerns of interest to me and of abiding public significance, which are science, politics, and agriculture. By then, I was also very keen. I mean, I had... See, my education in sociology and anthropology beyond coursework was a bit, you know, of a mishmash. You know, like a dilettante, I was reading whatever caught my interest. But one thing which I had figured out by then was that I'm keen to study up. That is, I wanted to study powerful institutions like seed companies, scientific agencies, and federal bureaucracies. So that also attracted me to this topic, that here's a chance to study agricultural biotechnology. And not just how, you know, farmers may be responding to it. So I changed my topic in my very first term at Yale. I mean, this is not the topic I had proposed in my statement of purpose. And my advisor, K. Shivaram Krishnan, was very supportive. And that's how the journey culminating in this book began. Now, as far as GM crops go, there are issues specific to genetic modification or the recombinant DNA technology that make GM crops controversial, in particular, whether or not they pose risks to the environment, to consumers, and to animals' health. So to give you a small illustration, BT cotton was never approved and until date has not been approved in India as a food crop. And yet BT cotton seeds are crushed into edible oil. They are a component of vegetable oil and certainly in Western India, in Gujarat in particular, you can get cotton seed oil, crudely or, you know, very finely refined. Now, studies show significant differences in lambs fed with BT versus ordinary cotton seed meals. For instance, in the weight of the liver, in the amount of fat in the testicles. So in a similar vein, BT protein is supposed to degrade in the human gut within minutes. That's the assurance that was given to the Environment Ministry in 2010 as part of the BT Brinjal dossier. And yet, BT protein has been found persisting in pregnant women and even in fetuses. So, you know, these are just two illustrations. There are, in addition, serious concerns about the BT gene or the herbicide tolerant gene. These are the two principal traits of GM crops available worldwide. There are concerns that these traits can circulate, can proliferate in the environment through pollen and contaminate biodiversity. So such findings make ecologists, farmers, and consumers nervous. Then there are broader issues having to do with the unsustainability and injustice that lies at the heart of the global food production system. GM crops are predominantly available in commodity crops like soybean, corn, maize, and cotton. Their cultivation is linked to escalating pesticide and herbicide use, monoculture farms, and implicit or explicit corporate control over seeds. In essence, basically, GM crops are controversial both on account of the uncertainties of the recombinant DNA technology and because they neatly dovetail with capital-intensive, debt-inducing, crisis-ridden models of agriculture. And that brings me to the stakes of the book. The standard way of thinking about the GM controversy is in terms of a global David Goliath-like struggle by farmers against exploitative multinational agribusinesses like Monsanto. I argue in the book that this narrative implicitly universalizes the story of the development of biotechnology in the West. We effectively end up handing over scientific innovation to the West and end up looking only at how activists and farmers struggle for or struggle against a ready-made technological product in the global South. But as I show in this book, the Indian experience is actually more reflective of the global experience, because across much of the world, the state is heavily involved in funding and promoting science and in assuming the responsibility of food provisioning. So the interplay of science and politics is deeper in India, in Brazil, in Bangladesh, because here the idea that science can simply be left to experts, or that food can or seeds can just simply be left to the market, these ideas have very little currency here. Ultimately, the fundamental question that the Indian debate has highlighted is, which bodies of science can address issues of public interest surrounding GM crops? This is a much more probing question than the question of impacts of GM crops. And it involves forms of public reasoning around both interests, questions of interest and questions of evidence.
That's really, really interesting. And I think it anchors the conversation about the book really well. So thank you for giving us the context of not just the empirical context, but also your stakes and the provocations that you raised through the book. And you mentioned while talking about the book that you wanted to study up and you wanted to study like, you know, powerful institutions. I would love for you to speak a little bit about how you went about doing field and archival research for this book. Who were the primary stakeholders you were studying? How did you access them and where did you go?
Thanks. In retrospect, that's a fun question. Of course, when I was going through this, it was nerve-wracking would be too much, but certainly anxiety-inducing at points.
Definitely.
So, Sneha, as you have written, too, fieldwork involves both preparation and luck. My empirical design was broadly along the follow-the-object dictum by Bruno Latour. So I wanted to conduct fieldwork inside agribiotech laboratories in the public and private sector, state regulatory agencies, and NGOs critical of GM crops. My basic intuition was that I wanted to excavate how, in everyday terms, these three arenas produce facts about GM crops, what uncertainties and ambiguities hide behind their public positions, and how they contest contrarian facts about GM crops. My advisor, K. Shivaram Krishnan, pushed me to conduct fieldwork also with farmers. I confess that I was initially skeptical because I didn't think farmers were really speaking involved in the GM debate. But he very astutely foresaw that farmers will have their own ways of responding to the debate. So accessing each site of my research came with its own set of challenges. But persistence and repeated visits and requests paid off. It helped that Yale is very generous with funds for graduate research. And it also helped that I had a background in engineering and management consultancy. I'm very often told that my journey into anthropology from electrical engineering means I've wasted a seat, you know, an engineering college seat. But I actually feel that even that preparation has helped me do this research. So in 2013-14, which was my period of uninterrupted research, I began my fieldwork in Delhi because I was most nervous about getting inside the Union government. Initially, I kept hitting a wall, and so I decided to conduct interviews with retired scientists and bureaucrats. With the help, so you know what happened, it's somewhat disorienting while you're going through it, that you wake up in the morning and it's like you're supposed to be doing this research, there's a clock which is ticking, and you don't really have appointments lined up, or so what do you do? Or rather, in this case, ethnography, so you don't have a place to go to where you can start your participant observation. So with the help and advice of academics like Dinesh Abrol, Ajay Dandekar, one of the pioneering biotechnologists of this country, Pushpa Bhargava, Deepak Pental, and of course, A.R. Vasavi and the scientist activist Suman Sahai, before this participant observation could work out, I basically decided to spend my time tapping into archival material in different libraries of Delhi and trying to set up appointments with retired bureaucrats and scientists who, you know, are generally a little more open to speaking than those serving in the government. Eventually, I was able to persuade a central government officer involved with GM crops to take me on as an unpaid intern. And then the ethnography began. I also worked with seed companies and farmers in Maharashtra, where brinjal is commonly cultivated. Also, I can speak Marathi. I also did field work in a state agricultural university in the south. And once again, all of these sites came with their own sets of challenges. And I'm very grateful to the large number of people who enabled this research.
The book asks and answers how democracy is reconfigured during and via controversies around GM crops. And it's divided into three parts. And each part deals with one aspect of the story of GM crops and their institutionalization in India, sciences, the state, and agrarian capitalism. So let's start with actually what you just talked about, the archival research that you did. So let's start with the first part, in which you trace the emergence of biotechnology in India and contend that it's primarily a state project, unlike, say, the US, where much of the scholarly debate has tended to focus on, and that there were considerable conflicts around GM, around the emergence of biotechnology in India through the 60s and 70s. So could you explain what the contours of these debates were in the 60s and 70s in India?
Yes, I think this has been one of the most interesting pieces of my research. It's commonly thought that the periodization goes as follows, that the Green Revolution happens in the 60s and 70s, in the 50s and 60s. And then around the 90s, you get GM seeds and associated with that, the new Green Revolution, the second Green Revolution, or the Evergreen Revolution, as it is called. What I actually found out was that molecular biology begins in India much earlier. It begins around the time of independence, as a number of biochemists start getting trained in what was then called new biology or modern biology, in places like Stanford, Caltech, Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, in the US as also in England. And something which I had not anticipated, which I found out while doing these interviews and archival research, is that, actually two things. One is that previous to this generation, so if you look at, you know, an embryologist like Panchanan Maheshwari in the 30s and 40s, Panchanan Maheshwari does not think that it's important for a student of biology to go abroad for his or her training. His own son, however, Satish Maheshwari, who's part of the first generation of Indian molecular biologists, is very dissatisfied with the kind of training available to him here and believes that absolutely he must go abroad and for doctoral and postdoctoral work to learn about what's happening in genetics. So this first generation of new biologists are much more oriented towards the West as the previous generation. They've come back to India, they are young, they are headstrong, and they find that they can either go to the conventional botany departments or they can go to agricultural science universities, and neither is of interest to them. So in the 60s and 70s itself, there's a debate which begins inside, you know, in the frictions that they have with their colleagues in universities. Whether, you know, universities like Delhi University or agricultural universities, where they believe that they are doing cutting edge research and there is no room for them. And that is what now India had a structure of science policy making where both Nehru and then later Indira Gandhi and even up to Rajiv Gandhi, scientists, there was an apex group of scientists which enjoyed considerable political heft. And coming from the colonial era, there were all these research councils, the Indian Council of Agricultural Research, the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. So what these scientists do is that, embattled within their existing positions, they start lobbying the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research and the Department of Science and Technology for enhanced state patronage to molecular biology. So the, you know, so there was no doubt in anyone's mind that the state will have to take the mantle of promoting molecular biology. This is very different from how molecular biology begins in the US, where the principal funder initially are the philanthropic foundations like Rockefeller, right, the Rockefeller Foundation. So here, they are very clear that it has to be the state. They don't really have an agency. They don't have an alternative source of funding to go to. And so the debate really becomes very quickly about what form, what is the organization design that the... So it gets very quickly turned into a debate of bureaucratic design. So Pushpa Bhargava wants a public sector corporation which is backed by an R&D. He calls it the R&D cum production unit. M.G.K. Menon is curious whether it should take the form of a government department like the Department of Science and Technology, or a commission like the Atomic Energy Commission, which was begun by Homi J. Bhabha's efforts. So the debate really is about organization design, and implicit in this is the notion, which gets crystallized in the 80s, that biotechnology is its own separate field. Separate from its own field, separate from agriculture, from medicine, and from food. So actually speaking, when molecular biology begins in India, it has almost nothing to do with agricultural sciences, which is also Jack Kloppenberg notes that this is also the case in the US. And this whole idea that, you know, this is a new and improved agricultural science is a much later construction.
In that vein, how did biotechnology and biotechnologists begin to gain a foothold, especially vis-a-vis farming policy in the 1980s in India? How did that sort of switch happen?
So that's a fascinating question. In all the discussions around launching biotechnology in India, almost without exception, the most tepid response would come from the Indian Council of Agricultural Research. So how did this biotechnology gain a foothold? They didn't directly. In fact, this first generation of new biologists were very skeptical of agricultural research, which they dismissed as applied work. As Satish Maheshwari told me, as the late Satish Maheshwari, unfortunately, we lost him just a few years ago. And he said to me, you know, I want to work on fundamental questions. Let someone else figure out how to improve yields. So there was this casual dismissal of agricultural sciences as if, you know, it's just applying something whose fundamental contours has been developed by molecular biology. So there was never any direct... So at no point, at least in my research, did molecular biologists say that, look, we have to seize control of agricultural research. But they have exercised a huge amount of influence indirectly through three ways. First, through their training programs in coordination with the University Grants Commission, by offering a parallel center for research funds, extramural research funds, at a remove from the Indian Council of Agricultural Research, and through its regulatory policies. I trace in the book how these training programs that the Department of Biotechnology, so actually, you know, I should also say that that people like Pushpa Bhargava and Satish Maheshwari start lobbying for a serious commitment from the Union government around the 60s and 70s. And by 1986, they win a federal Department of Biotechnology, which is reporting directly to the Prime Minister, which it, at least in my reckoning, must be one of India's most successful social movements. So what the Department of Biotechnology does following the 80s is it works with UGC and starts biotechnology programs initially in six or seven universities like Madurai Kamraj Universities, the IITs, IIT Kharagpur for one, Delhi University. And later, it expands them across universities. So this is where you get your bachelor's in biotechnology, BSc biotechnology programs. Now, what is this program? Crudely speaking, they were training, they created a substantial class of scientists trained in recombinant DNA or other molecular biological research methods, but without an adequate appreciation or background in plant breeding, which is, you know, the art and science of creating varieties and hybrids that are actually viable for farmers. So, you know, this construction of this class of biotechnologists, people trained in biotechnology, who then had to be gainfully employed either in the private sector or the public sector, exerted certain pressures on the public agricultural research system. The availability of funds, the Department of Biotechnology invested heavily in recombinant DNA research. So given that the ICR post in the 70s, like after the Green Revolution, starts going into decline, if you're a scientist in a state agricultural university, you will get oriented. In my interviews with the public sector agricultural university brought this out very clearly. You know, scientists said that we understand that recombinant DNA technology is a very limited tool, but that's where there are, but you know, the funding is in molecular biology. So we have to do some of that also. A senior administrator of the ICAR said that even they are concerned that plant breeding is getting short shifted, even though plant breeding is more important in, or more directly of interest to farmers and agriculture. And finally, regulation. Regulation was taken charge. The Department of Biotechnology and the Union Ministry of the Ministry of Environment and Forests took charge of regulating GM crops. They involved the Ministry of Agriculture, but these two agencies were really running the show. So in all these manners, basically what ends up happening is implicitly plant biotechnology starts overshadowing a broader program of agricultural research. And this is the indirect way in which whether they wanted or not, they started shaping farming policy based on a narrower base of expertise.
Thank you. That was really, really illuminating. In chapter 4, you analyze how civic epistemologies are put forth around the regulation of GM crops. And you outline two documentary modalities of truth claims, which are legal, administrative, and scientific. And you do this by delving into two controversial cases from 2008 and 2011. The case of Dorito chips being allegedly laced with unapproved GM ingredients, which actually I remembered that whole controversy from 2008, and the withdrawal of a previously granted no objection certificate for conducting GM mustard trials in Rajasthan. So I would love for you to share with us what these cases were all about and what comparing them allowed you to argue vis-a-vis the regulation of GM crops.
So I was working, so at the back of my head were two notions that I wanted to really interrogate when I was looking at this material. One is, I didn't pick up on Doritos in 2008, but I've since then never been able to, you know, see Doritos with the same innocent eyes. Okay. So one is this notion which is commonly held in India, that the United States is very strict about GM crops and generally on regulation, and Indians are very lax. That's one notion. The second notion was that Indian regulators, and this is more held in scholarly circles, that the Indian regulatory agencies are technical agencies par excellence, to borrow from Ian Skoons. And the problem is that through their technical, you know, through their technocratic approach, they are sidestepping, you know, what are really political questions. When I see these two cases, and especially the Doritos case, what struck me, and that's what I try to do here, is that, well, even when confronted with an outright technical problem, India's apex regulator, which is the Genetic Engineering Approvals Committee, as it was called in 2008, and now it's called Genetic Engineering Appraisals Committee, they actually did not do the one thing that you would expect any technocratic agency to do, that is actually collect samples and test them for accidental or whatever, for presence of GM food. So how did they deal with it? They dealt with it by basically interrogating Greenpeace itself and taking a documentary submission from PepsiCo. They asked Greenpeace that prove to us that you have purchased this sample of chips in India. Now, for for some very logistical reasons, Greenpeace had lost the receipt. They had, taken a receipt anticipating this question, but they lost it when they were shifting their offices in Bangalore. So they could not furnish a receipt. And basically, the absence of receipt allowed the GEAC to dismiss the complaint. So how do we make sense of this? This is obviously not some, technocracy sidestepping political question. Something else is going on. So now, going to that first point, which is how do, that Israeli American regulation or Western regulation strict and Indian regulation slack? That may or may not be the case, but what I'm trying to show through these cases is that regulation always involves blending two different kinds of epistemic frameworks. Regulation is never just about assessing facts or, analyzing facts, and nor is it just about, pushing through politics in the guise, pushing through political positions or political priorities in the language of technical reason. They are always sitting, straddling, both technical reason and administrative logic. And that allows, as I show in the chapter, both for certain surprising decisions like the Rajasthan government's decision to burn the field trials of a very, very respected senior public sector scientist, Deepak Pentel, who has been a part of Prime Minister's science advisory councils and so on and so forth, while there's a Congress government at the center and a Congress government in Rajasthan. So something surprising like this can happen. And something surprising like India's apex technical body refusing to investigate what's happening with Doritos chips. All of this is enabled in this interstices of two epistemes. So I wanted to argue against this notion that, regulators are corrupt, regulators are incompetent. I mean, they may be all that. I'm not conclusively saying one way or another it's possible that such logics also operate in regulatory bureaucracies. But more importantly, what is the bureaucratic practice through which even incompetence plays out? That's where I was trying to do. And this in anthropology, there's been this idea coming from scholars, coming from some very fine scholarship by Akhil Gupta, Nayanika Mathur, and others, that one way to study bureaucracy is to partition them into elites and subalterns. Or you can say senior bureaucrats, junior bureaucrats, and by the vertical principle of authority. And I wanted to add to that by saying that bureaucracies can also be segmented by technical specialization or horizontal division, functional specializations, which creates a more complex architecture of power. Ideas that I thought these cases speak to. And in terms of the consequences or rather implications for the larger DM debate, I think it's very important that we do, and this has been something that Dr. Suman Sahai has been repeatedly saying and trying to address through her public interest litigation, that you do have to think very carefully about regulatory design. It's somewhat lazy to, dismiss them as only, politics in the guise of technical reason or, incompetent, corrupt, etc.
And in the next chapter, you explore the various efforts at resisting GM crops. And what are the analytical affordances of following the emergence and the deepening of activism against GM crops? And what were some surprising findings for you?
In one sentence, if I were to say this, the anthropological injunction, by scholars like Akhil Gupta, Aradhana Sharma and others is to disaggregate the state. And few movements have done this better in India than the than the movements critical of GM crops and the movements who have a wholesale, I mean, a blanket opposition to all GM crops. So, you know, it's linked to this question. I am often asked that, okay, what do you mean by genetically modified democracy? And that question, if anything, has become even more urgent as we see palpable shrinkage of democratic spaces in the last 8 years or so. What analytical effort is, I think, see, going back to what I said earlier, that in countries like India, the state is the custodian of both scientific development and public welfare. And that creates certain schisms and tensions in the federal architecture, which activists have very shrewdly, painstakingly deployed to, you know, reinterrogate or to basically ask what kind of a GM or what kind of an agri-biotech program does India need and do we want. So they have been able to jockey department against department. They have lobbied state governments against the union government. They have got the parliament. I think one very heartening finding has been for me the two parliamentary standing reports on the issue of GM crops. They were unanimous reports. The first in 2012 under the chairpersonship of Basudeb Acharya. That was when UPA was in power. The second under the chairpersonship of Renuka Chaudhary. This was the Committee on Science and Technology, Environment and Forests. And this is when the NDA is in power. They are both unanimous reports and they exhibit such a intelligent, thoughtful grasp of the issues that there's really so much to learn. And it was really, it was just so wonderful to see that how the parliament can really, you know, function as a legislative and policy thinking body when it is allowed to. So this is what I really mean by, this is the emergence and deepening of activism against GM crops arguably is a narrow topic, right? Because even if you succeed in keeping GM crops out, you still have your agrarian crisis and you still have all the problems of farming and food in this country. Nevertheless, this somewhat narrow focus has allowed a very large constituent number of, galvanized a large number of constituencies who have then jockeyed different parts of the government. They have jockeyed the parliament, they have jockeyed the judiciary to get involved. Something which I find very amusing is there's been a demand from some nationalist and some nativist groups that the union government of Ayurvedic, Unani, Siddha and Homeopathy, which is under the Indian Council of Medical Research, ought to be sitting in every regulatory meeting and just to make sure that genetic modification does not tamper with medicinal crops. And this demand, although it's not been conceded by the Ministry of Environment, but it has been taken with great gusto by the Ayush department. Now, I'm not getting into whether that's a good idea or bad idea, but I'm just showing the spectrum of, you know, democratic contestations that have happened around GM crops. And let me just say to conclude this answer that a lot of this book is, you know, my research ended in 2014. So a lot of this book shares the story coming up to the UPA2 and the BT Brinjal moratorium. There's been, no doubt, that level of debate, that level of interdepartmental strife, we do not see in the NDA years. I mean, we are hard-pressed today to find ministers contradicting one another in public or different departments writing strong adversarial letters to the Prime Minister's office. All of this had happened with GM crops and with other issues also during the UPA time. But I do feel that something that the one contribution of GM related activism is that it has opened up these questions, and these questions are not going anywhere, and they may not be very visible right now, but perhaps you know, in some years, they will again rise to the surface. So I do feel something has changed in our public culture where it has become much more okay to question the, you know, science and regulatory authority, question policy making around scientific issues in a way that, for instance, did not happen with the anti-nuclear protests. And I think one sign of that is that although Prime Minister Modi has broken with and broken massively with prior precedents, for instance, in Kashmir, but on the issue of GM crops, the UPA stalemate continues.
Yeah, thank you. And I think what I really enjoyed was how you're thinking about democratic participation through thinking through the GM crop debate. And I feel like linking it to larger questions around politics was is really a major highlight of the book. And thank you for elucidating that so brilliantly just now.
Yeah, if I could say one more thing, I think
So
the anthropology of democracy as the field has evolved has tended to look at, you know, for instance, cultures of protest, which are no doubt important. But I think there are also issues of there's also the other side of in the anthropology of democracy, which is what happens inside state bureaucracies. How do they respond to social movements? What kind of knowledge frames do they draw on? And I think the GM debate in India illuminates these in ways that, you know, just goes beyond like a, you know, a South Asian case study or an Indian case study.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you were just talking about how you weren't prepared or you weren't thinking about farmers being a part of the story that you were planning to tell through this book. But then you did actually end up, you know, bringing that perspective into your book. And in the book, you make a very important argument against reading too much into the so-called promising sales figures of crops like BT cotton as a direct evidence of their popularity amongst farmers. You even write that when you expressed skepticism around whether sales figures actually tell us about whether farmers are indeed enthusiastic about BT crops, you were told by both journalists and policymakers alike that, you know, farmers are not fools to be duped into something against their wishes. Actually, like, couldn't help but laugh a little bit when you write about that interaction rather confessionally. But you went on to persist with your skepticism of this perspective, and you argued through medical evidence that critically interrogating the terms on and the conditions under which farmers access and purchase agricultural inputs is actually very key to understanding their relationship with new technologies better. So could you explain what you found via this critical interrogation and by taking into account farmers' engagements with agricultural inputs?
Yes, absolutely. It was actually, I mean, I heard this from a number of people, but with most conviction, I heard this from Dr. Montek Singh Ahluwalia, who was then the deputy chairman of the Planning Commission, that, I mean, with, you know, in his crisp British accent, that are you trying to suggest that farmers are fools? I mean, they're clearly buying this. But if one pays attention, there are two claims here, right? The two claims are, one, that these seeds are popular. The second, therefore, they are also working for farmers. Now, it's the second claim which I had difficulty, I still have difficulty accepting. Because what are we trying to say? I mean, if I give a crude analogy, Pepsi and Maggi sales are also going up. And Maggi also advertises itself as very good for our nutrition, with all the right balance of, you know, whatever, carbohydrates and micronutrients and iron fortified and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But are we trying to therefore suggest that it's indeed good for our nutrition? Coke is good for us? Is that the argument? And if one were to challenge that argument, is the implication that consumers are fools for buying it? So I am very skeptical of this idea that a sales transaction turns somehow on the purchaser's intelligence. Or which is to say, there are many other things happening also in the interaction. It's not in the main about, you know, whether I'm competent to make the sale or not. So I think what was most, I should say what has been one of the most disheartening findings for me, this has already been flagged by number of scholars of agriculture, in like A.R. Vasavi, like Isha Shah, is and for instance, Glenn Stone's work, Andrew Flax's work on fads and BT cotton is what is happening to agriculture knowledge. See, the thing is, if we are to say that the fact that the farmer is purchasing these seeds means that the farmer has concluded that these seeds are good for him or her, and although at least in my fieldwork, these shop transactions were principally, were without an exception, transacted by men rather than women, we are assuming that there's some kind of a knowledge base on which you know, the farmer makes such decisions. And I found that actually there is no, that what the farmer ends up buying is very often, or basically exactly what happens when we go to pharmacies also, right? It's like we want a certain medicine, but the pharmacist tells us that maybe we should try something else. And sometimes we resist that pressure and sometimes we capitulate to that. And in a similar way, actually, I found a lot of similarities between how anthropologists have been writing about generic pharmacies and medical advertising in India, and how they've been, and what I was seeing with pesticides and seeds. Generally speaking, even dominant caste farmers like Maratha farmers are not very sure of themselves when they enter the seed shop. And this again is something which I just want to say, that this is one of the, like, I found why ethnographies are so important. Because in all my interviews, and I had designed some very extensive schedules, all my interviews farmers said that we buy what we think is best for us. It's only when I went on the other side and I mean, there were some very kind shopkeepers who allowed me to sit in their shops for hours and simply observe sales transactions happening, that I realized what the very important role that marketing agents, corporate marketing agents, that is, agents of companies like Syngenta, Tata Rallis, who go village to village advertising their products, and these retailers, the enormous role they play in pushing products onto farmers. Compounded by the fact that you don't really have any Indian language term for GM crops. So for a lot of farmers, BT cotton is a brand name. It doesn't indicate, you know, a different kind of seed. Compounded by the fact that the discourse in English around GM crops is very different from the vernacular discourse on GM crops. To give you a small illustration, this is something which my collaborator Chitrangda and I saw in Odisha, you know, 2-3 years ago. On the Andhra border, there are a lot of these spurious BT cotton seeds available. Let me ignore the spurious seeds. I have with me a packet of Nuziveedu's BT cotton seeds, which are legal. Nuziveedu is India's largest seed company. And behind the seed packet is a disclaimer in English which says that the pink bollworm has become resistant to BT cotton. So what is the farmer purchasing here? English is not a language that either, you know, this disclaimer is neither available in Telugu nor in Odia. So, you know, so this is what I mean by saying that how can we make this about farmers' intelligence? We have to look at the entire political economy. We have to see, you know, the changing sociology, the changing agrarian relations, which are much more responsible for what gets bought by product, what gets bought by farmers, than by the intrinsic merit of a certain, intrinsic utility of a certain product. On just to on a final note, you know, about 4 months into my fieldwork in Western Maharashtra, a farmer took me aside and said that come sit, you've been irritating us with your questions for 4-5 months. Let's see what you've learned. Let's see how much you understand agriculture. The next set of questions were entirely about agricultural products. So for instance, what is mancozeb, a fungicide? What is fertira, a pesticide? What fungicide should I use on my grapes, right? Now, if I look at older ethnographies of agriculture, see, entirely absent from this Q&A, this quiz, was like, you know, any knowledge of cultivation practices. So there is no doubt that for a variety of reasons, agriculture, the collective knowledge held by farming and laboring communities has been progressively getting eroded. in favor of knowledge about packages of practices. Now, that is the context which is not unique to GM crops. That's the broader context of our agriculture. And therefore, in this vein, it becomes even more erroneous to you know, use only sales metrics as indices of popularity and success. We have to ask far more probing questions.
It's funny because there's a reversal there, right? Like you being asked the questions actually becomes the detail of your ethnography itself, which is, I love those reversals when they happen during fieldwork. You know, you write in the book how you've been asked very often what your stance is on this whole BT or GM crop debate. Yeah. Would you like to speak about that? Like what happens when people often ask you your position on this, and how do you generally respond?
You know, I've gone back and forth. I mean, I've tried out multiple answers to this question, but over the years, you know, I do feel that the question itself is wrong, or in a way that it's like asking what is your position on a hammer.
Yeah.
So GM is a tool. It can do certain things and it cannot do other things. I think the right question is, what will address the agrarian crisis, the crisis of sustainability, and the crisis of rural injustice, or the crisis of injustice? If we start with that question, if we address, you know, what are, how, if we start from that question, if we see what are the measures that will alleviate or help address some of them, then we can see whether or not GM is part of the package, you know, of the solution space or not. Otherwise, you know, it's a solution looking for problems. And we have to, you know, in terms as anthropologists, as concerned citizens, we have to keep our eye on the problem and not take a solution and see where can I fit it. With that said, so, you know, so in the book, I say that I'm neither pro nor anti-GM, but over the years, I think it's becoming increasingly clear that BT cotton has been fairly disastrous for India. There's a recent review by Keshav Kranti and Glenn Stone. Keshav Kranti is the former director of the public sector Central Institute of Cotton Research in Nagpur, which is a very damning indictment of the BT cotton hybrid program in India. The evidence on herbicide tolerant crops and herbicides is even more damning. So these two traits, which are the principal GM traits, I am increasingly coming to the view that they are not really part of any solution space. Now, we will think of further, you know, other potential GM crops as and when they are closer to ready. But with the caveat, like I said, that we have to start from what we have to ask the right questions.
Yeah, I completely, I love that, especially the response about this, like asking someone, how do you feel about a hammer? that's great. Thanks a lot. I learned so much from the book, but I feel like I've learned so much more on top of that through this conversation. And I really appreciate you taking time out and indulging my questions. But I have one last question for you before I let you go, and which is, what are you working on now and what can we hope to read by you in the near future?
So there's no indulgence. I mean, I've really enjoyed this. And thank you for these questions, which has given me another chance to, you know, think about some of this research material. I'm working on two projects. The one is like I mentioned, my collaborator Chitrangda Chaudhary and I are working on these herbicide-tolerant cotton seeds, which are just proliferating across Odisha. We have published two, you know, preliminary pieces on it in the People's Archive of Rural India, and which we have fairly, which portend fairly serious consequences for the agrarian economy, for biodiversity, and for health. So that's one thing which we are trying, which I'm working on currently, that how are these seeds circulating, what kind of knowledge displacements do they involve, what kind of shifts in sociology do they involve, as you know, seeds which have often been nurtured by, you know, intergenerationally by women of the household, get replaced by seeds coming from the market, purchased by young people with dreams of prosperity. By young men with dreams of prosperity. So that's one. And then secondly, another interest of mine is really the Right to Information Act. And I'm also just seeing how that has evolved it's since 2005. So basically, we are approaching its 20th year in 2025. So these are two areas in which I anticipate working going forward. Or not anticipate, I'm working on going forward. I mean, now and going forward.
Yeah. That's awesome. And I look forward to reading and learning more about this. Thank you for taking time out and doing this. And good luck with the rest of the semester and the summer and the rest of the year.